This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hey everyone, Gil Gross here, post-match. Rafael Nadal versus Alexander Zverev, Roland Garros 2024, first round. If you're not here for spoilers, click off the video. Zverev beats Nadal in straights in what could be Rafa's last Roland Garros match. Certainly, it feels probable, but it is not 100%. And it looks like we'll find out more after the Olympics. If we're being realistic here, because I'm not going to start with analysis of the match, I'm going to first talk about the occasion, what this moment was. That's number one. And then the match is going to be number two. If we're keeping perspective here, this was mission accomplished in a lot of ways. And it's hard in the moment to understand tennis matches in any way other than a contest where you try to win. It's really hard to go beyond that, especially in the moment. But if you go back to, I think it was March, but I'm not positive, and Nadal is clearly suffering setbacks that were unexpected after the last 2 years have been so tumultuous with the injuries. It's like, all right, we're doing this again. And he basically says, look, this is probably my last year, and I do not want my career to end in a press conference. So as soon as he said that, I said, okay, I guess that is the goal here, that we're going to try to play the schedule healthy, a level that he can be proud of, so that there can be kind of a proper send-off. And I think this was that. I think this was a match that Rafa can be proud of, that he should be proud of. So he went from saying, I hope that my career doesn't end in a press conference, or I don't want it to after this match saying, if this was the last time, I enjoyed it. And to me, that was a concession of peace by Rafa, which was good to see, because I know he's worked really hard to create the moment that he created. It was a loss in the first round. I still think he worked really hard and had to grind and suffer a lot to even get to that point. It was amazing to see Nadal's colleagues come out, to see Alcaraz, to see Djokovic, to see Swiatek, and I'm sure there were others. There were some tremendous points, some tremendous shots that can be cherished, that were quite magical as moments, time capsules, so to speak. And again, I think you just didn't want to see Nadal go out limping, and I don't think this was that. I think this was a pretty cathartic moment for Nadal and tennis fans and Nadal fans. And I am sensitive to how Zverev's involvement in all of this could have made it more difficult to have this be this cathartic moment. And I apologize for missing the mark on that in the draw preview, because there are some people who struggle to embrace Alexander Zverev as a member of the ATP Tour right now, and that's completely understandable. The level of tennis, moving on to the match, was high. An A-plus performance from Zverev, and from Nadal, an ability to match it sometimes, but not always, and not when it was all on the line. And you certainly got the feeling, watching the match, that if Nadal were playing someone with abilities that weren't really in the 1%, that he would have been winning. But Zverev's abilities, they're in the 1%. And he was doing things in this match constantly and putting that package together constantly that is just not normal on tour. It's elite, you know? And what he was doing off of his forehand and his backhand and his movement and his serve, all of it. And let's get into the detail on that. And it starts with the mental aspect of Zverev's performance, because I do think that this was a pretty tough spot for him. The weight of expectation was very much on him. It's no way to settle into a tournament. And I understand for Rafa, he would have liked to settle into the tournament with an easier draw. But I think that the same could be said for Zverev, especially when there's probably more pressure on him to contend for this title than there has been in a really long time, given the perceived vulnerabilities of the top right now. And winning Rome will do that. It's a good problem to have, but I do think that makes the first round especially tougher mentally. And Zverev could have tried to make it some sort of physical war. He could have come out playing a little bit safe and, you know, feeling Nadal out and hoping to get gifts. What I most admire about Zverev's performance is he really didn't do that. Instead of trying to make it a physical war, he fully embraced the war of tennis skills. And he played offensive tennis when he had opportunity to do that, and he did it at a really, really high level. The forehand picked up where it left off in Rome. And if you're Zverev, that's the most important thing. We talk about that because that's the part, that's the puzzle piece that is often missing. He was really accelerating through the forehand, plus entirely unpredictable in terms of location. He was taking his forehand down the line very often, which has not really ever been his comfort zone. It's been his worst shot from the baseline. And if you're Nadal and you know that, what's the pattern? You're going to drill backhands cross court, and then you're going to look for runarounds off of that. And if Zverev trades his forehand cross court with high quality, then you hit another backhand cross court. High quality, another backhand cross court. High quality, backhand cross court. Low quality, now we run around, we crank a forehand inside in, or a sharply angled forehand inside out. It's kind of the pattern. Like, we're going to work in the deuce side if you're Nadal against Zverev. Work that deuce side cross court and find that runaround forehand opportunity. Or I suppose sometimes you'll have a chance to step in and be aggressive with the backhand. But when Zverev is constantly changing direction with his forehand down the line, you don't allow Rafa to settle in there. What he ultimately wants to do is work out of one corner. So I thought that it disrupted that pattern that Nadal would have wanted to look for and kind of couldn't, because Zverev was taking his forehand down the line too often, breaking up that pattern. But also, just by nature of Zverev using both sidelines and not only hitting a ton of forehands down the line, a ton of backhands down the line. I think the down the line rate was really high for Zverev. By nature of him doing that, he's working both sidelines, and you're offensively too. So he's offensive minded. He's working both sidelines. You're making Nadal move more, which is always, if you're employing a tactic that's going to make Nadal move more, that is, at this point, inherently good. So that's the forehand. And also, by the way, in defensive situations, Nadal wants to anticipate. And from the middle of the court, and even on runarounds, Zverev has often favored the forehand cross court and the forehand inside in, because he likes to come around the right side of the ball. Nadal would love to just sell out to that direction, and he did a couple of times, and Zverev was able to burn him on a couple of forehands from the middle of the court because he doesn't go to his favorite directional. And for every step that Nadal loses, the more it's important that he is reading the game well and anticipating the patterns and kind of being one step ahead. And Zverev's unpredictability went a really long way in ensuring that Nadal couldn't do that in this particular match. Now, while the forehand is probably the most important thing for Zverev because it's where he's sometimes vulnerable, the backhand is still the main thing that is making things difficult on Nadal. It's capable of just incredible things, and I thought over and over again, you could see rallies where Zverev was in positions on his two-hander where Nadal normally finds an opportunity to be offensive and feasts from there. And it's just so hard to go into Zverev's backhand and to get anything weak or anything short as long as he can keep two hands on the racket, meaning as long as he has enough time to actually drive the ball and he's not hitting a defensive slice. What Nadal does on his forehand is what most players do on a kick serve. You are dragging someone. He is dragging someone off the court, and the ball is going not only away, but it's also going up. So it's high and off the court. You're above the shoulders where you're weak and you're out of position. And it's such a tough spot for righties because you're not going to get all that much on the ball if you don't have a strong backhand in the first place, especially if the ball's high. And if you take that cross court, and you probably have to if your timing isn't excellent and you're not able to change direction there, you're probably taking it cross court. And if it's not great, Nadal's going to hit a big forehand down the line. And it's the scariest forehand in the history of clay court tennis. And you're telling me I have to hit a high backhand into that weapon? It's a nightmare. It's a total nightmare. But Zverev simply cranks the ball. Like, it's as simple as that. First of all, I was really impressed with how often in that position, high backhands on the run, Zverev was hitting the ball hard down the line, making Nadal hit on the run, open stance backhands. That one goes cross court. Zverev gets there in plenty of time and the point's back to neutral. Most players just, they can't do what Zverev does with that ball, where you're taking a high backhand and you're ripping it down the line regularly with enough quality that Nadal is left a little bit rushed and kind of not stepping into his backhand and not able to get enough on the cross court to counter. Anyway, you look at the 3-all game in the third set. You have the serve and volley by Nadal on break point, and Nadal and Zverev just vaporizes a backhand winner on the return. Before that, he took one of those backhands down the line on the run that kept the point on Zverev's terms, and then Nadal missed a backhand. And then on the first point of the game, it was a return deep middle by Zverev's backhand that rushed Nadal into an error. The other point was a double fault. So as much as the forehand is the part where you're like, wow, he's crushing his forehand, he usually doesn't do this, that's the part that's different. The backhand has always been a problem. And it's just incredible to watch against Nadal, whose forehand still, at least in the second and the third set especially, still has plenty of jump off the court. It's amazing to see that neutralized so easily. And by the way, I talk about the defensive aspect of it. I talk about Zverev defending his backhand in a way where Nadal isn't gaining any sort of advantage and not able to create short balls. But is there anybody better at attacking backhands off of short balls than Zverev? I'm not sure there is right now. So that was key in the first set, certainly, because there were a lot of short balls coming off Nadal's racket. And it's also key just on the plus one. So for Nadal, I thought the biggest problem for him, other than Zverev doing the things that I just highlighted, were actually the nerves. Because in the first set, it was pretty simple what was happening. Rafa was getting nothing on the tennis ball. He was overspinning the ball. He was not getting any depth, which is a symptom of overspinning. Another symptom of overspinning is you get no speed. So you get top spin, but you don't get anything else. It's all spin. There's no speed. There's no depth. And that's just, it's just attackable. So I just thought Nadal's ball from the back of the court was really, really easy for Zverev to tee off on. And Rafa has kind of always had that habit or that bad sensation when he's nervous. When he's very nervous and uncomfortable, he does tend to do that, to overspin the ball. But there's been a sense where, okay, with his defensive skills and his movement, he can actually recover from that mistake. He can err in that way and bail himself out with his scrambling. That is non-existent now. As soon as Nadal drops the ball short, especially with an offensive-minded and highly effective Zverev stepping in on both wings and hitting the ball to both corners, Nadal's toast if he hits the ball short. And that's what was happening in the first set. It just wasn't a quality ball that Nadal was producing. And then in the second set, he did relax, and he was able to up the speed and he was able to up the depth. He started hitting the ball bigger off of both wings. Plus, he made a big time correction from the Hurkacz match. Really, a huge improvement. Because you can recall in the Hurkacz match, he was getting himself into offensive positions and ripping forehands, and Hurkacz was just defending it. So clearly, Nadal's forehand is not quite the beast that it used to be. He has lost a percentage of potency because there was a time when you're just lights out there. Like when he steps into three forehands in a row, you're not really going to, he's going to finish you no matter what. And that was not the case against Hurkacz. That was not the case here against Zverev. But remember my critique in the Hurkacz match was he needs to come in and finish off these balls. If the forehand isn't enough to get the job done, he needs to come in because he's still moving the ball around the court really well, opening up angles, changing directions. If you kind of put all things together, the precision on it, the spin, opening up the angles, still pretty fast. Like I think I saw he was averaging in the second set 77 miles per hour on the forehand, which is still solid. Like it's enough to do damage, but maybe on clay against great movers, great defenders who are retreating in good defensive position, it's not enough to do point-ending damage. So get up there and finish. And that's what Nadal was doing in the second set. Net points won for Nadal was 18 of 20. Freaking 90% for the match. But in crunch time, he did get away. He got away from it. And there were some key points in the tiebreak, and he needed to win the second set after settling in and starting to strike the ball better. And credit to Zverev for also hanging in there. But there were some points where Rafa was dictating, and he didn't find the finish, and then he got countered, or he started to feel control slipping away, and he went to the drop shot. And he lost 2 points down the stretch in the tiebreak, going to the drop shot. Let me kind of tell you exactly when they were. They were at 4-3, and Nadal hit a desperation drop shot, which also comes down to the physicality, because if Rafa was fully confident in his ability to play 40 balls, then it wouldn't matter as much that he's struggling to finish on his forehand and off the ground in general, because you know he wouldn't mind the point being neutralized over and over and over again. But in this case, he did mind it. He got himself a little bit out of position trying to take a forehand down the line. And then on the run, moving to his right, he went for a really, really low percentage drop shot. And Zverev guided a forehand down the line for a winner. And then at 4-5, I wrote the same thing. Nadal dictating but staying back. And then eventually he runs out of ideas and drop shots. And Zverev reads it and guides a backhand down the line winner. It's two drop shots that really led to easy retrievals by Zverev that he could take advantage of. And to me, it's just in those nervous moments, Rafa didn't quite trust himself early in the point. Let's take a big cut and come in, because that's what was working all match long, and Nadal couldn't quite recognize that. And then on the nerves topic, because again, I think that's what I'm talking about, the 6-5 point is painful because Zverev got tight. He hit a tight first serve. It was not a Zverev first serve. It was a weak first serve. It wasn't fast. It was not in a good spot, and Nadal just didn't make the return. So that one hurt as well. I'm glad about how the post-match went. I'm glad they didn't do a ceremony. Nadal took the mic. He was genuine about how he was feeling in the moment. He talked about where he was at in that moment, and I thought it was appropriate that we kind of got something that I think left the door open. It's not going to get awkward if Rafa is back next year. And it's also not going to feel to me like there was any sort of lack of, anything lacking if Nadal doesn't come next year, because I feel like you can still do something. If Nadal decides to retire, you can still honor him at Roland Garros next year. He doesn't need to play a match. So just with that in mind, thinking like, okay, it's not as if you can't give Nadal a moment to formally say goodbye on court Philippe Chatrier. It's not as if you miss that opportunity if he doesn't come back. You can do that even if he's retired. And lastly, I want to weigh in on where he's at with his retirement. So, selfishly, I would love him to keep trying to play because I like watching it. And it's good for tennis in a lot of ways. But for his sake, I think I want him to plan a stopping point. Because if he just keeps playing until as long as he feels good, he's just going to keep playing. The feeling good is just going to end at a certain point. And then he'll get hurt again. And I just don't want him to keep playing until he gets hurt again, which may be out of his control. But the way I think I'd rather him go about it is set a stopping point. Set a stopping point and try to go until then. I think that's better for him. I think that's a healthier way to do this. Just because if the mindset is, here's what I've never understood about the way Nadal has approached this. If the mindset is, well, I actually feel pretty good right now, so I might just keep playing. That's not a permanent state. You feel good until you get injured. That's how this has worked for the last 3 years. That's how, in some ways, this has worked for Nadal's whole career. And that's not going to suddenly stop as he turns, the next birthday is 39. Look, I don't want to do the whole Nadal sentimental thing. I'm not going to sit here and pay tribute to him in any way. But I obviously, the memories for Rafa at Roland Garros, the dominance at Roland Garros, one of the most impressive things that has ever been accomplished in all of sports, countless impressive performances and the full body of work is unlike anything we'll ever see again. Hope you enjoyed. Don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you next time.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.